And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am reporting live from Washington, D.C., well, you know, as I usually do. But now I'm in the heart of the city, in the heart surrounded by more greens than you can shake a fist at. I don't know, I've seen so many environmentalists in one room. Usually environmentalists don't even get in a room. They're usually out in some forest somewhere. So this is a very huge gathering of people from all across the nation, all focused on green jobs. I believe it may be the largest green jobs conference that's ever been held. I'm not sure about that. I'm going to ask my guest. Maybe he'll know the answer. My guest today, by the way, is very, very important, not just to the horn, but also to West Virginia and to trying to make the case that old technologies, old fossil fuels, old sources of energy are not our future, and they don't even make sense. One of the fascinating things is that environmentalists obviously know and show that the that wind and other renewable energies are better for our environment. That, I guess that goes without saying. Everyone sort of knows that. But what Coal River Mountain Watch is proving is that it's better for our economy, too. That even if you didn't give a damn about the environment, and every person in this entire hotel does today, that even then, if you just look at it as a matter of jobs or profits or local taxes, actually wind beats coal. And to make that argument, I've invited Rory McElmoyle here. He's been with Coal River Mountain Watch for a year now. And Rory, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Hang on a second, Rory. Bob, I'm not sure I'm hearing Rory's microphone.
Now you will.
All right, you're right. I do hear him now. Go ahead, Rory. Tell me again what you were just saying.
Okay. Well, thanks for having us. Thanks for having me on the show. Like you said, I work with the Coal River Mountain Wind Project, which is a campaign based in southern West Virginia through Coal River Mountain Watch. And Coal River Mountain Watch is a community-based organization based out of Whitesville, West Virginia, whose mission is to bring an end to mountaintop removal coal mining while also starting to develop sustainable economic alternatives. And so that's where our Coal River Mountain Wind project fits in. And it's really an honor to be here at this conference and be able to talk with other great environmental and economic minds from around the country to sort of change the system so that projects like ours can come to fruition and old fossil fuels and especially destructive methods of coal mining can be rendered economically illogical. So
right. Well, let me ask you this. One of the things that I guess I learned is I read through literature, and I guess maybe I should have known this. I apologize. I'm not from West Virginia. But there actually is a Coal River Mountain that you're watching.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just sort of a name. You know, when I hear Coal River Mountain, it sounds like, there's coal and there's river. What is Coal River? What is the Coal River Mountain? Why is it called that?
Well, it's called that. I'm sure it's been called that for a long time. A lot of locals don't really refer to the whole mountain as Coal River Mountain, but on geologic maps, that's the name of it. And it's a very expansive mountain. The whole mountain comprises probably about 30 to 40 linear miles of ridgeline. And it's surrounded by some of the most beautiful communities and most beautiful valleys that I've seen in all of southern West Virginia. And so for local folks know certain parts of the mountain, like Risson's Knob or Low Gap or, you know, other places like that, and they've never really thought about it. Many haven't thought about it as a whole mountain.
Did it once have a river of coal or something?
No. No, I mean, I really couldn't tell you the history of why it was named that way.
No, what's interesting is that even in a mountain that's named for coal.
Well, actually, it is. So there's the Coal River runs through southern West Virginia, and it's one of the bigger rivers. It runs into from there into the canal, which runs into the Ohio. And so it is. I mean, it's basically the Coal River flanks the mountain, so I'm sure that's why it's called Coal River Mountain, actually. And the Coal River is so named because it's one of the most historically mined areas for coal in all of central Appalachia.
That makes sense. I'm curious to know. Bob, am I being heard okay? Is my sound coming through? Because it's all right. Great. Coal River, how clean is Coal River? I mean, when I think of Coal River, I think of a river full of, you know, coal.
Right. Well, the Coal River is actually it's heavily contaminated. It can't even hold – fish populations like it used to. The trout that used to run up there are all gone. They have to actually stock fish for the locals to fish in just to, you know, have that activity to do. It's filled with, it's worse than it used to be, because before it was just underground mining in the area, mainly up until the 70s when they just started doing small strip mining, which they call contour mining, which just, they just cut out a cut around the contour mountain and then mine the coal that way. But now, of course, they're blowing up mountains, so you have higher levels of sediment, a lot more releases from runoff from the valley fills, which is basically when they blow up the mountain, they take the soil and the rocks and the trees and they dump it into the valleys below. And that runoff has a lot of toxic heavy metals and other elements that were locked up in the coal that aren't good for environmental sustainability or human health. So.
What's interesting is that, you know, when you think of a mountaintop stream, you think normally of the cleanest water on earth.
Right.
I mean, you know, you go and you buy a bottle of water, and they always tell you it's from the mountains because you don't want to have it down you know, near the end, near mm-hmm. the port, where all the sludge and so forth from all the different areas. The cleanest areas is up in the mountains. Not true with Coal River.
No, that's right. And actually, it used to be. I mean, before coal really started polluting the area, coal is actually a filtration. It serves as a filtration system. So the water coming out of these mountains, when it's in place, it serves as a filtration system, and it's only when it's disturbed and mined and the water starts mixing in with the oxidized chemicals that were locked in the coal does it become poisonous. And so it used to be some of the cleanest water that you could find around anywhere.
So I'm curious, when you get your drinking water in your county, do you get it out of the Coal River? Do you have to then filtrate all those sediments and everything out of it again? Where do you get your water?
Well, we're lucky enough to actually get water piped into us. But most of, and that's only because we live in sort of a small pocket where that happens. Most folks up and down the Coal River Valley actually still use groundwater. And a lot of their those water resources have been now contaminated due to, like, what the coal company does now is they'll clean the coal before they ship it to a power plant. And there's a lot of chemicals involved in that process. And what happens is you get this toxic coal slurry that has all sorts of toxic heavy metals, mercury, arsenic, selenium, all sorts of things. And then they either put that into huge earthen dams or they inject it into abandoned underground mines. So that pollutes people's water because that gets into the groundwater. And they never show with certainty that it's not going to get into the groundwater, and it always does. It's without fail. And
so here you have a place that used to have some of the cleanest water in the country, now has some of the worst. And the people who have the cleanest in that county would be people like you who have it piped in from somewhere else.
Basically. Well, even that water is not very clean, but it's not nearly as dirty as what other folks have to live with.
Now, how long? I mean, coal's been mined in West Virginia since the 1800s, right?
Yep.
Okay, so a very long time. And the way it used to be done, at least way back then, and up until what, the 1970s, virtually all coal mining was underground mines?
Yeah, it was 90-something percent of coal mining was underground mines. It was around the 60s and 70s where they first started using small forms of surface mining, like contour mining, which even back then folks rebelled against. I mean, you had locally driven protests and activist movements. And
what is contour mining? You hack into a mine? You hack into the side of a hill?
It's basically like taking a strip around the contour. You leave the peak alone, and you just cut a strip around the contour, and then they drill holes into the coal seam. So they create like a bench, an L-shaped bench around a contour of the mountain, and then they drill in and pull the coal out by auger mining is what they call it. And that was so destructive that people rebelled against it back in the 70s because they loved it. I mean, they loved their mountains. It was very intrusive for their way of life. And
I assume that people who want to live in the mountains often like mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
they don't usually hate mountains and trees and fresh air and fresh water. People who want to live in the country.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's why they're called mountaineers, and they take very, very strong pride in that. They have a long history there. So now
the people rebelled against it, but the companies just went for it.
Well, that led to the passage of the Surface Mine and Reclamation Act, Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, back in 1977, and that was a product of Jimmy Carter and the whole social movement against surface mining, against contour mining. But what that did, that act failed to regulate mountaintop removal. It basically codified mountaintop removal and allowed it to happen with certain restrictions. And certain.
So the act said you can't dig around the mountain, but you can blow the whole thing up?
Well, it just didn't restrict mountaintop removal because mountaintop removal was not very prominent back then. And
the mountaintop removal, I don't know. To me, even that sounds a little too calm. I mean, you could call it, it's what, exploding a mountain? I mean, what is mountaintop removal?
I mean, you could call it the complete...
Bombing the mountain.
Bombing the mountains?
Yeah.
A war on Appalachia.
Mountain bombing.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's a better term than mountaintop removal? Mountain removal
Indeed.
Sounds so quaint. I don't know. It kind of imagines like, you pick up the top of a teacup and you look underneath and grab and put it back.
Right.
Why not call it mountain, I don't know, explosions, mountain bombing?
Well, I mean, people always do. You know, mountaintop removal is a general term. Other
mountain
like,
dynamiting. I don't
mountain
know. Is
dynamite.
It dynamite? Is that what they use normally?
They do. They use a mixture of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. And,
and they literally blow the whole thing up.
Right. They one piece by one piece. The first thing they do is they'll clear cut the forest that's up there. And this is some of the most highly biodiverse forest in the world. And it's a temperate rainforest. And so they clear cut that. Oftentimes they either just dump the trees in the valleys or they burn it on site. Most of the trees up there have been extensively logged over time. And so it's not commercially, I guess, profitable for a timber company to come in. And then they'll scrape out the soil. They'll take that and they'll dump that into the valleys below, and then they'll blast the rock one layer by one layer to expose the seams of coal that are underneath. And sometimes it'll be hundreds of feet of rock and underneath that's above that coal, and all of that goes into the valleys. So
I see you're waving at someone. You're free to do that.
There's a fellow right here that came down and did some great work down with us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe he should join in. Tim, you want to be interviewed as well, or...? Okay.
Yeah, you should bring him on afterward. He was doing some great work. He came down and joined us for about a week. So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. That's good. I'll tell you. If you'll stick around, we'll put you on the air as well.
He definitely has a great perspective to add. So.
Okay. Stick around a little bit, will you?
Cool.
Okay.
So yeah. I mean, basically, it's just coal seam by coal seam. They're going after thinner seams of coal. It's the cheapest and therefore most profitable way for the coal companies to make their money.
Now, the coal companies own this land, or is some of it public land, or where does the land come from?
Sometimes the coal companies own the land. Sometimes they just own the minerals. Sometimes they own neither, and there's an absentee landholding company. Most of West Virginia's mineral rights and surface rights are owned by land and mineral-owning companies that are based in Pennsylvania or Missouri or other places.
They bought them, what, 100 years ago and just sold them?
There was a big land grab when prospectors and speculators first realized that Appalachia was rich in resources, and they took advantage of the fact that people in Appalachia didn't have this legal idea of, you know, like ownership of the land. They lived off a communal system. And
that reminds you of the Native Americans that sold Manhattan for $24 in beads.
Right.
It's sort of the same idea.
Exactly.
At that time, the Native Americans didn't understand the concept of selling land, because how can you sell land? You can't sell the air or the sun or the water or the wind, so how can you sell land?
And then, I mean, you know, the folks just didn't foresee what was about to happen. And even when they did, these land companies came in and falsified records or... You know,
but if they own the minerals but they don't own the land, how the heck can they blow up the mountain?
Well, it depends on who owns the service. Sometimes they'll buy those service rights. They'll pay like an individual landowner, or sometimes like there's a land holding company that owns the service, right? So they have to lease the service rights or something like that. But
and Coal River Mountain, who owns that now?
There's two land owning companies. One is Roland Land Company. They're based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Another one is Western Pocahontas, who is now named the Natural Resource Partners. And
Nice. Name someone who blows up the environment. Natural Resource Partners,
right.
That's a nice Orwellian name. A nice ring to it.
And they're one of the worst. They're one of the worst around there. So.
The worst in terms of pollution?
Just in terms of just an aggressive takeover of land and minerals and not caring about the impact of their... Land use decisions on local communities.
But, Roy, you know the argument, and frankly, it's the argument that you hear all the time from West Virginia politicians. And that is, okay, yeah, so coal ruins the environment and ruins our water and ruins our air and so forth. But jobs, man, people are poor in West Virginia. A lot of people have jobs in the coal industry. So we pollute our lands. What can I say? At least people are getting food to feed their families. How do you address that argument?
Well, before they started destroying mountains, they had a little bit more of an argument because what they do now, and There's a lot of issues with underground mining. But Mountaintop Removal is so exponentially worse, you know, that it has to be stopped for a lot of reasons. And so our counter-argument in terms of the Mountaintop Removal issue is that your job is not worth my life. Your job is not worth my property. Your job is not worth the health of my kids, you know, or my unborn child or my parents' health, you know. So, and that's really where it comes down to.
Are there more jobs in the old underground mining or more jobs in exploding these mountains?
Bob? There's actually the surface mining has led to a rapid decline in coal-related employment across Central Appalachia, mainly because it's more highly mechanized. You can, per ton of coal produced, and this used to be a more stark contrast, but per ton of coal produced, with surface mining, for that same ton of coal, if you mine it underground, you produce two jobs, whereas with the surface mining, you just produce one.
Okay, so already jobs are halved. Jobs are halved, totally apart from the environmental impact. The jobs are halved just by the fact that they're blowing up the mountain rather than digging into it and getting stuff underneath.
Right, exactly.
Now, your organization, I should say, has put forward a very nice little glossy thing that I have in front of me, December 08, so it is timely, mm-hmm. that compares the cost and the profit, and both in terms of dollars and in terms of electricity, of mountaintop removal, of mountain bombing. I would just call it mountain bombing. That just seems a lot more accurate to me than removal, because removal.
I mean, you're not lying.
Okay, so the difference between mountain bombing and wind production.
Uh-huh.
Now, how much wind can be produced in West Virginia? Are there wind farms in West Virginia?
Yeah, there are. There's actually currently, within a few months, there will be a total of 330 megawatts of wind, which is enough to power approximately 70 to 100,000 homes. Depending on...
Already, right now in West Virginia.
Right,
you could power 70 to 100,000 homes.
Yes, yeah. So those wind farms, well, 230 megawatts exist right now, and then there's another 100 that's just about to be completed construction. So once that happens, then that wind power could power 70 to 100,000 homes in terms of the amount of energy that it would actually produce over the course of the year when you take into account that the wind doesn't blow all the time, right? So...
Now, how long have those wind farms been in West Virginia?
The first one came online, I believe, sometime in 2003 to 2005.
So, like 5 years ago. I mean, this is brand new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And already it can power 70 to 100,000 homes.
Yeah, and there was already a study showing that West Virginia has nearly 4,000 megawatts of wind potential. And that study was done 7 years ago. And the technology for modeling wind potential is so much better now. And so, I expect that there's well above 7,000 megawatts of wind potential in West Virginia.
One of the things I noticed in your nice little glossy thing here. By the way, I assume people can get this somewhere, like on your website, or they can download a PDF or something?
Yeah,
like
let me read it for everybody. So, sure. It's called, one of the main strategies of our campaign to get a wind farm on Colbert Mountain as an alternative to a 10-square-mile mountaintop removal mining site was to get an economic study done that would analyze, that would compare the economic costs and benefits of the two options, wind and mountaintop removal. And so we commissioned a group called Downstream Strategies out of Morgantown, and they made a report for us. They produced a report for us called The Long-Term Economic Benefits of Wind versus Mountaintop Removal Coal on Colbert Mountain, West Virginia. And we have that should be available on their site, which is downstreamstrategies.com. But you can definitely download it from our website, our campaign website, which is coalriverwind.org.
Well, here's what I found that I thought was very interesting. I was just looking at your map of the United States, and it shows areas where there's a lot of good wind potential mm-hmm. and areas where there isn't a lot of good wind potential. And obviously, there's very good wind potential in where you might expect the Great Plains, where you've got, you know, vast plains
yep.
where wind can blow and so forth. But what's interesting to me is if you look at the South, the Southeast, mm-hmm. that's some of the poorest wind potential in the country,
mm-hmm.
just from this map. You can see this big white, with the exception of Appalachia.
Right.
Appalachia, there's like a little line drawn down Appalachia, down through West Virginia, down through the heart of Eastern Tennessee, Western North Carolina, where it's almost like a river in a desert,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or I think of the Nile River in the Sahara Desert, where it's so important, not just because it's a big river, but because it's the middle of desert. You have wind potential in Appalachia that you don't have anywhere around it
except for
hundreds of miles.
Yep.
Why do you think this potential hasn't, I mean, it's only been around for 5 years. Is it the technology that's new, or the will, or the drive? Why is it only now? I mean, windmills have been around since Holland. I don't know how many hundreds, probably 1,000 years there. Why is it only now starting in West Virginia?
Well, the East Coast has been way behind in terms of moving forward in energy production and progressing toward a more environmentally friendly and more climate-friendly form of energy production.
Is it a political decision? Is it a technological thing?
There's a lot of political. Yeah, I mean, you know, take a look at West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Eastern Tennessee, and Southwest Virginia. That's where a lot of that Central Appalachian wind potential is. For example, West Virginia has known since 2002 how much wind potential they had and how much wind potential was in the southern part of their state where all the mountaintop removal mining happens. And they didn't even put that information out to the public for 5 years. So, I mean, that right there was a big political just suppressing that information. And,
is wind technology much better than it used to be?
It is. It's advancing all the time. Like, just between when we first looked at this in 2007, we were using 1.5 megawatt wind turbines as the model because at the time that was the best one for this type of location. And within 6 months, all of a sudden, we were able to use a 2 megawatt wind turbine. Gamesa Energy produces one that
increased by one third in half a year.
Oh yeah.
So that would mean that in 5 years you could triple,
well,
four times.
Probably not that fast, but I mean, there was definitely a nice little boom there. And the technology is getting a lot better. The turbines are becoming more efficient. You know, you don't want to put onshore turbines much bigger than a 2 to 2.5 or maybe a 3 megawatt in the plains, because then they just become really big monsters. You know, once you get that big, you want to put them offshore. And that's one thing we're not doing, is not using enough of the offshore wind potential right now. So when we should be.
Well, let me ask you this, because I want you to sort of, people don't have the report in front of them the way that you and I do. But one of the fascinating things I found about this report is it's not an environmental report. This
right.
is not a report that says wind so much cleaner than coal. That goes without saying. Wind is of course clean and coal is of course dirty.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the argument you're making, how clean the water would be and how nice the environment would look. Your argument is purely based on economics.
Yep.
Purely based on jobs. Maybe you could use the report and let me know. Compare for me the jobs.
Right,
I started to hand Rory the report. You don't need a silly report. He knows it by heart. So tell me this. In terms of jobs, just in terms of pure economics, obviously we're in the greatest downturn since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
How is wind better than coal?
Well, so first and foremost, underground mining, like I said, produces twice as many jobs per ton of coal. So one thing that this report analyzed was a multiple-use strategy for the mountain, because the purpose of Coal Mountain is to transition the region away from coal, especially by ending mountaintop removal, so that there will be jobs. And
I wish I could
benefit.
Get you to just call it mountain bombing.
I've decided that's
the best way to call it. First of all, it's more accurate.
Yeah.
Second of all, it just seems, you know, it draws the senses more to exactly what's going on.
Okay, I'll try to
keep saying mountain bombing.
Mountain bombing.
Let's start right here. Let's start calling it what it is.
All right, so let's say that we're trying to transition away from mountain bombing.
Right.
Also, Raleigh County coal is running out in all of Appalachia. The quality of the coal has been declining, which means we're producing more per kilowatt hour produced. And at the same time, you can't find a 5-foot coal seam in southern West Virginia anymore, whereas before you had 12-foot coal seams, right? And everybody knows the coal's running out. They're just ignoring it. And they're just trying to hype up the coal industry as much as they can and support that industry. But so what this report did was it analyzed a multiple-use strategy. It looked at an extensive underground mining within the permit boundary and a wind farm, which we found that technically you can do. And compared that to the mountain bombing situation, and it found
that...
And
then you get a pure wind, I guess, would be the third option, right?
Well, no, I mean, the whole thing is a comparison. But, yeah, it does look at just the wind versus MTR and the wind farm by itself. So we're looking at two scenarios. One is where it's just a wind farm building
right.
on coal mountain.
So you got three possibilities. You got mountain bombing, you got underground mining plus wind, and then you have wind alone. Those are the three.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we always, you know, the underground mining, the additional benefits, there would be 78 new jobs with the underground mining. But just looking at the wind versus mountaintop removal, right, just that direct comparison, we looked at two wind scenarios. One, or downstream strategies did. One was just the development of wind farm, what those economic benefits would be. And the other was, if southern West Virginia were to support the development of a wind industry, and say a wind manufacturing plant was sited in Raleigh County, what would those benefits really then look like, and how would the county benefit? How would Southern West Virginia benefit? And how did that compare to mountain bombing?
Well, I think maybe the best way to compare it would be, you know, versus energy produced, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to see how many homes it would light. I mean, that way you're comparing apples to apples.
Well, sort of. I mean, but that's, and we'll get into that. But first and foremost was the economic argument.
Okay, I will
talk about the energy issue. But in terms of jobs, the wind farm would produce less direct jobs than the three mountaintop removal operations, but over, I believe it was 28 years, the study found the cumulative number of jobs with the wind farm would exceed those of the mountaintop removal operations.
Because eventually you'd run out of mountain.
Right. And the mining plant is only for 17 years, and then the mountain would be destroyed. 9 miles of streams would be buried. The community would be devastated. You probably have a lot of excessive flooding. I mean, all sorts of consequences are going to happen in association with the mountain bombing on Cold River Mountain. But then when you look at, well, if Raleigh County were to support our campaign and say we're not going to allow mountaintop removal on this operation, we're going to support a wind farm, we're going to pass a resolution and get the governor to back us, then you would then start to create a momentum in Southern West Virginia where, because mountaintop removal is destroying that wind potential, because what it does, it reduces the ridge altitude, and then...
Yeah, you can't build the whole purpose of building a windmill on top of a mountain is it's got a valley around it, so there's a lot more wind.
Exactly.
I mean, all of us know, you stand at the top of a mountain, you feel a very sharp wind. You're down in the valley, you don't feel much of a wind.
That's basic
mechanics there.
No, that's true.
I mean, you know, you stand out in the field, you feel a wind. You stand in the middle of Manhattan between two buildings, unless there's a wind tunnel effect, basically. So actually, what's fascinating when you think about it is that mountain bombing doesn't just destroy the mountain. It actually destroys the potential of future energy through wind.
Yep, that's true. Exactly. I mean, for 17, what the governor and the county so far have seemed willing to do is to sacrifice the future economic vitality of this area, future economic potential for the area, for only 17 years of coal.
Yeah, they're saying, for 17 years, we'll give you good, and after that, you know, you're on your own. I mean,
right.
I mean, you have no chance. Basically, you should just desert West Virginia and leave, because then you won't have the beautiful mountains that you moved there in the first place to enjoy. Mm-hmm. You won't have any power. You won't have any jobs. You won't have any energy for 17 years of the deal with the devil, if you will, and then that's it. Bye-bye communities, go away. It could be like those abandoned western ghost towns, mining towns of earlier years.
Yep, and that perfectly illustrates the conflict that's going on right now, because as the study showed, in terms of county tax revenue, the wind farm would bring the county, on average, perpetually, forever, $1.74 million a year in property tax revenues. The mountaintop removal scenario, when Raleigh County received its share of the severance taxes coming from the blowing up of Cold River Mountain, the county would only get $36,000 a year.
Wait.
Right.
That's an extraordinary difference.
50. It's a factor of 50.
$1.7 million a year.
Yep.
You're not talking about over the course of 20 years.
No.
$1.7 million a year.
Per year.
And now you're telling me that in property taxes, they get $36,000 a year.
That's coal severance taxes.
From the coal.
From the coal.
Times 17 years, I'm going to do a little bit of math in my head, and I come down to about maybe $600,000, $700,000.
Somewhere around there.
What I think you're saying is for the entire life of coal, they're going to pay less than one-third of what the wind people will pay in 1 year?
Yep, exactly.
That's extraordinary.
Well, see, and there you go. So this builds up to the fact that the conflict is between that the wind farm is better for the public. It's better for the local communities because they don't have to deal with the social and environmental externalities of the coal production, which aren't included in the cost of coal. And then they also have jobs and tax revenue, which that extra tax revenue could be used to stimulate new economic development. And that's the beautiful thing about wind power across the country that's being developed in rural areas, is it's a much better economic boon for that area than any resource extraction has ever been.
Okay, so part of the problem is, and this was the problem, frankly, when we went from horses to cars, right? All those blacksmiths, they lost their job,
right?
When you change technology, people have to learn new technology. There are a bunch of people right now in West Virginia that have their coal job. how much time would it take to transfer coal jobs into wind jobs, and when would wind jobs exceed coal jobs?
Well, the wind jobs in this situation, if it was just the wind farm, it would exceed the total mountain time removal jobs in about 28 years. So about 11 years after the mining would end, the cumulative jobs with the wind farm exceed those that the mountain time removal would provide. But like I said, if that local wind industry were created, if Raleigh County said, hey, we're going to support wind development, you know, because we see a future in it and we see that it's better than even all coal mining that's happening in the county, then it's feasible that a wind manufacturing plant could be sited in Raleigh County. And then from year one, in that scenario, from year one, wind provides more jobs than mountaintop removal
from year
perpetually,
one.
From year as number
long
one.
As now can I, but basically you have to convince some wind manufacturer to come in to Raleigh County.
And how do you do that? You support the development of wind farms.
So
such as
what is the cost of building a wind turbine facility, and how much of it would a wind manufacturer produce? How much do they want from the government to do that? What kind of resources do they need?
Well, I mean, that all depends on what the state and federal policies are. Like, for example, this wind farm would probably cost around $700 million, but most of that cost would be borne by the developer themselves. Right? It's not like the local communities are going to be.
Well, for example, you mentioned the wind farms that already exist in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all done privately?
It was all private.
Without any government help?
Well, actually, the state government actually moved to make it harder for wind farms to get developed. They increased the business and occupation tax from 5% to 12%, which is good for the state. I mean, you know, on the state level, the wind companies don't have to pay that much. But, you know, it does make... They do go to places where it's more economically
fair. So rather than subsidize wind,
they made it a little bit harder.
They tax wind. They make it harder to do clean energy than to do dirty energy.
Right. But, I mean, but the wind industry is like any other industry. Really, we shouldn't be subsidizing any of it. You know, unless like right now, the coal industry is heavily subsidized from the federal level to the state level.
How is the coal subsidized?
Well, first of all, the federal government, for example, in the new economic stimulus bill, just the Senate version of the bill is trying to give away, I think, $4.6 billion to the coal industry.
Okay? Yeah, you say give away.
Yes.
Just a pure tax break.
It's part of the stimulus bill.
They don't have to do anything for it. They just get it.
Well, I mean, I'm sure some have to do with loans and other issues, but, I mean, it's $4.6 billion to an industry that is destroying our environment. It's
okay, but Obama tells us that the stimulus package is about green energy. How much is going to wind farms?
I believe in terms of the whole green package, there's like $100 billion total. That doesn't mean just wind farms. They've also, I believe each bill includes both a production tax credit and a investment tax credit, which is good because, I mean, the wind industry...
So is it going to all energy equally, or is at least green energy doing better under the stimulus than...
I think both solar and wind, any renewable energy benefits from that one. But here's the difference. So wind energy and solar energy impose a very small, like minuscule, social and environmental cost, especially in relation to coal.
There's virtually no cost except you might not like the look of the turbines, and a few birds might die.
Right, but who likes the look of smog, or who likes the look of a coal-fired power plant? You know, who likes the look of sludge in their water?
Or a mountain that's been bombed.
Right, or a mountain that's been bombed, exactly. So, I mean, that's really not the issue down here. And you know, there's a smart way to develop wind, but... So two things I'd like to point out is, like I said, the true cost of coal is not being included. And on top of that, the federal government and the state government are giving away tax breaks and subsidies. And so coal is artificially cheap. There was a study, rough study out of, I believe, West Virginia University or Oberlin College or somewhere, that showed that just at a basic level, if you try to include just the health costs related to coal, you know, people with respiratory diseases from power plant pollution, or people... with diseases down in the coal-producing areas from the dust, coal dust or silica in the air or contaminants in the water, that would add an extra 20 cents minimum per kilowatt hour, and nobody would be buying coal electricity. Right now, coal averages like somewhere between 6 and 8 cents per kilowatt hour, right?
It's always true with pollutants. You know, pollutants are cheap only when you don't count, what you said, the externalities. When you don't count the fact that someone's got to clean up that pollution, that makes it cheap. It's always cheap. You know, my sewer bill would be very cheap if I could just, go in someone else's yard.
And dump it, right.
Exactly. In order to dump in their yard, hey, you know, I'd pay no sewer bill.
Right.
No water bill at all. Now, my neighbor would not like it very much, but hey, for me, it's cheap.
Pretty cheap.
Yeah, so that's...
And I think that's the exact sort of perception that the coal industry has. So,
Yeah, they're dumping in our yard. I know you got a friend here that you wanted to introduce. Why don't you tell me who he is and what he had to do with
Well,
the
Brett here. Brett here came down to do some
Brett,
awesome
Mark
music.
Levine. I'm good. We're live on the radio right now on the Inside Scoop, and I've been interviewing Rory, and he says good things about you.
Yeah, and I want to go ahead and give it over to him so he can talk, because he learned a lot. He came down and stayed with us for about a week, and really was all over the place. I mean, he met all the best locals and hung out with them and learned all the best stories. And one story about Brett is that he was the second day he was there. He had sort of the same paranoia I did, you know, when I first got down there, because it was the coal, you know, it was coal country. And he was walking around.
They were going to come in and bomb you or something.
Well, no, I mean, you know, like I heard about goons, coal goons and all these things, and there is a lot of tension, and like you really
can't.
There's
a whole coal mafia, basically.
Well,
you can walk home and find like a lump of coal in your bed, kind of.
No, but I mean, well, yeah, like the horse head, but no.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to say that it's that bad, because really, I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, that sort of misrepresents and stereotypes a lot of things that are, and hides a lot of the true problems and true conflicts that are going on down there. Because a lot of people do depend on the coal industry, right? And a lot of people do believe in coal, and they're proud of their coal industry.
And it sounds like in this report, you're suggesting that even a compromise where you continue the underground mining for a little while.
It's a transition.
As a transition to the wind.
Right.
So you're not arguing for end all coal mining now.
No.
What you're saying
just
is
stop,
end
no,
the
stop
mountain
moving.
Bombing. Keep underground mining as a transition period as you get those wind farms.
Right. And Appalachia has a great potential for developing a whole new green economy. And the sad thing is that their leaders are not supporting them. Their leaders are not saying, hey, let's look at what coal is really doing. Let's look at what the alternatives are. And let's start to develop those. You know, let's stop blowing up the wind resource. Let's stop damaging communities and losing our population. And let's invest in education and infrastructure and health and everything else.
Right.
And Central Appalachia can see a whole new, brand new future. And people could continue to live off their land. You can even have jobs in reclamation. You know, you can have jobs in cleaning up the streams and cleaning up the impacts
sure,
of the coal industry's past.
Sure, sure.
Those are all new jobs, and they're there, and they're ready to go. And we just need the political will and a whole sea change in the mindset of coal in Central Appalachia. So I want to tell a story about Brett.
Please. Now, Brett, was it you were an intern or something?
I forgot the name of your...
I teach environmental
science. Oh, he teaches environmental science. Okay.
What was the name of your website again? That's right, Homegrown Locals, homegrownlocals.com.
Homegrown Locals. So he came down to work with y'all for a week.
Yeah, and this guy's a badass. He's a kayaker. He's like all over the place, man. He came down and he intensely, like day by day, was there and like with a major intensity, was like learning as much as he could and meeting all the people he could. But it was like one of the first days he was there, he's walking through Whitesville, which used to be this booming coal town, right? And just like all coal towns, when there's a coal bust or when there's an expansion of surface mining, thus less workers, those towns die. And so it's a shell of what it used to be. And people will tell you 8 years ago, I mean, people were out there on Saturday nights. Now you can't see, you can almost hardly find anybody on like a Monday work day, you know, or even a Sunday church day. So Brett's walking through town, and because of all this, you know, this stereotype, and like, just like I said, when I had, he's walking around with a Friends of Coal hat on, just so he looks like
Uh-oh.
A friendly, right?
Uh-oh.
And I mean, you know, to be honest, that's pretty odd down there anyway, because nobody actually wears a Friends of Coal hat. But he was trying to make sure that he didn't, you know, that he could ease in and talk to people, you know, on a local level. And the first guy that brought it up, right? He's like, what are you doing wearing that Friends of Coal hat? He's like, oh, no, I'm all about coal. And he could probably tell us more, but then it turned out that the guy he was talking to hated coal.
He hated the Friends of Coal.
So he was like, oh, actually, I don't care. He like, took it off. It was all. So
right.
That was one of my favorite stories about Brett. So I'd like to go ahead and let him on, because he...
Sure, sure.
I'd like to share that kind of stuff.
Stick around a little bit, too? Oh, well, I guess we don't have that much time left.
I've got a reception to get to, so...
All right. Well, listen, Rory, I appreciate it. I appreciate your knowledge. You clearly... Let me ask you this, just before I bring Brett on. What can your ordinary listener do? I mean, if you live in West Virginia, that's one thing. We've got listeners throughout the United States. We've got listeners throughout the world on Head On Radio Network. You know, got someone in New York or someone in L.A., what can someone do to help you out, to help protect our resources in West Virginia, throughout the United States, and at the same time, you know, power the United States?
I'll put that as sort of a threefold ask to all the listeners out there. Mountaintop removal is one of the worst things going on in the whole world. I mean, through grad school, I was learning about, you know, extraction issues and its impact on indigenous people in Ecuador with oil, or deforestation in the Amazon. These are all things that are happening in developing countries they're hugely detrimental to the cultures and the environment. And the same thing's happening here in the United States. We shouldn't be doing it anywhere in the world. And the United States should be, you know, should be better than that. Mountaintop Renewable only provides 4% of the nation's electricity. Right,
I'm going to get you to call this mountain bombing.
Mountain bombing.
One of the things that Republicans taught us, the only thing smart they taught us, is that the way you phrase things count, right?
Yeah.
They changed the estate tax to the death
tax.
Well,
they got it now.
You know, but the difference is this is accurate. It really is mountain bombing. I mean, they're not removing things piece by piece.
Well, imagine this. I think it's over the course of a year. I forgot the time frame, but it's a maximum of a year. Every year in Appalachia, the amount of explosive used to bomb the mountains and completely destroy the culture and the environment there is equal to 58 Hiroshima bombs.
58?
So imagine
nuclear bombs.
Right.
A year?
Atomic bombs. Yep,
a year.
Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
That's impossible to imagine.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
I have a hard time imagining Hiroshima, much less 58 Hiroshima.
You can feel these blasts from up to 5 miles away, easy. Like, we hear them. We hear them just, it seems like it's thundering up my gun. Well, the blasting does, most often the blasting doesn't occur all night.
So it does all during the day?
Yeah,
they
have blasting times. Say, one mine, the Ed White mine, will between 4 and 5, it'll set off anywhere between 1 and 4 blasts. And they're huge. You know, and they rattle people's houses, and they put silica dust into the air, and all that stuff, all that dust comes straight down to the valleys where people live. You know, and it gets in the water, and it kills the trees. Like, it's horrible. So,
and obviously, the people know it's happening. The politicians, the West Virginia politicians, have any of them been down there during the explosions? Can you be able to Jay Rockefeller and say, hey Jay, let me introduce you to my town?
Rockefeller knows what's going on.
I know he knows, but I would love to see a video of him there during the mining, during the explosions, trying to justify it.
He'd probably call it progress. I mean, you never know.
He might.
Yeah, he's Rockefeller.
He might.
So, he's definitely deep into the
Hey, Roy, I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Well, let me say to your listeners, learn as much about mountaintop removal as you can. It's not needed. It's not necessary in the United States. It's only necessary to maximize profits for the coal companies and land companies. It only provides 4% of our electricity, and you can learn more. 4%.
That's it.
Electricity. That's right.
Okay.
And over 1 million acres of mountains have been blown up for that. And 1,500 miles of streams, easy.
1,500 miles of streams.
Over 50. It was 1,200 miles as of 2001, and so that doesn't even count the last 7 years. So go to ILoveMountains.org, learn what your connection is, learn what you can do, support the Clean Water Protection Act, learn about that. That would help just about put a ban on mountaintop removal, and that's we had almost 160 co-sponsors in the House before the new session.
Is this a bill that you think will pass the Democratic Congress? It'll
pass the
Obama?
House, but it has to pass the Senate. And right now they're having, because of Senator Robert Byrd, they're having a hard time getting it introduced in the Senate. So.
Interesting. So the problem really is that your two West Virginia senators are...
Yeah, they're not going to let it happen. So.
Are against it.
Yeah, but so there has to be more support.
Well, Byrd isn't going to live too long.
Well, I'm not going to talk about Byrd's health. I mean, to be honest, Byrd has been really important for West Virginia. Unfortunately, he's dropped the ball on protecting communities and really helping new economic opportunities develop. But he has been a great man for the state and has really done a lot.
I just think he's living a bit in the past, maybe as the oldest member of the Senate, and doesn't recognize the advantage of new technology.
Right.
Hey, Roy, thanks so much.
You bet. And everybody go to ColeRiverWind.org.
I'm going to bring Brent on here. He's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, looks raring to go here.
That's a good way to describe him, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Well, I can see it. I mean, you look at this guy, he's like always smiling, like he's like ready to go. So have a...
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! All righty are running hot, straight, and true from the Green Jobs, Good Jobs Conference here at the Marriott Woodman Park in Washington, D.C. I'm Bob. Welcome aboard. There are literally thousands of committed environmentalists and labor activists here in conjunction looking for a way forward, a future, a viable, sustainable, renewable future for this nation and this planet. It's been very exciting today. A lot of workshops going on, as well as very interesting plenary sessions and speakers. Not too terribly far in the recent past, Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius addressed the crowd here. Starting here in a very short period of time, the general reception will be taking place, and that should be quite the social event of the overall gathering. I am told that event will feature some remarks by none other than one of the godfathers of the very idea of liberal talk, namely one Jim Hightower. Now, I'm not promising anything, but the communications director for the Blue Green Alliance is a wonderful young lady by the name of Kelly Stringham. I have aggravated the very life out of Kelly for about 3 days now. But you know what? So far, she hasn't told me to go up a rope, so I'm going to count myself among the fortunate. As it stands, I went to her and I very politely asked her, listen, could you do me a favor? You think you could get me Jim Hightower in here when he's done doing his shtick, get him to come around? And she said, hey, can't hurt to ask. So one of the great voices in liberal broadcasting may be with us presently, and I'm hoping that that is indeed the case. That would be a couple of hours down the road. We still, you know, you would not. We're getting really good at this, Nick Regalado and me. Nick Regalado at the keyboard for your blogging pleasure. Say hi, Nick.
Hello.
No, that's where you say hi, Nick, back.
Oh, hi, Nick.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. You got, you know, the young ones. You got to work with them a little bit. We've got folks. We've got. I tell you what, we've got here just to set the scene for you a little bit. This is a lobby area outside the ballroom where the reception and the plenary sessions have taken place. And what we have before us is a great conglomeration of folks. A lot of people coming and going. Here at our table, we're set up here with the magic mixer, the official horn gig rig broadcast remote operation. We've got some Coal River Wind T-shirts out. We've got some Coal River Wind buttons available for those who would like to take them. And just letting people know what's going on in southern West Virginia, what we're trying to do because you know what? When you get right down to it, if we're going to green this nation, if we're going to green this economy, it has to begin in the heart of Appalachia and in the heart of coal country. Because until coal country is green, until mountain removal is ended, we can't say that we're greening the economy. We just can't. So this has been a very profound opportunity to get that message out. We'll be talking to some folks involved in the fight here presently. Nick is very very busily taking information and handing out some T-shirts and the like. This is just magnificent. I think this is I'm looking forward to talking to a lot of people coming in and out of the event this evening, and I think it should be quite enjoyable. We also have some tech work yet to do. I've got, and you know what? We've gotten rather good at this, I'm afraid, this business of
doing broadcast and tech at the same. You know, it's one thing to be a tech guy. It's another thing to be a behind the mic, behind the in front of the camera guy. To do them both at the same time, John Fox has taught me so well. There were a few years ago, I would have absolutely blanched at the idea of trying to do these two things at one time. Now, John Fox, John just says it's another day at the office, and that's what it is, and we get it going. So let me just check a couple of settings here and see if we've got phones coming in. A fella can dream. Okay, that looks good so far. And what do we have here? Okay, hold on. Oh, I have dial tone. Hey, John Fox, you're listening. You want to try to sneak in a test call? If you do, we're using 304-574-7814. 304-574-7814 is the number that we're using to take calls. If this all works and we get folks behind the microphone, well, heaven only knows what might happen after that. So that's what's going on at about 16 minutes past 6 o'clock here in the Eastern time zone. As far as, well, we're not going to go into the news of the day just yet. There's entirely too much happening here. Let's see, what can we do here? I'm waiting to see some communication come back at me. Okay, John's ringing in a sec. Okay. All right, just stand by. Bear with us. Wow. Can you imagine? It's got to be mentioned. We are here through the kind offices of the Sierra Club as well as Cold River Mountain Watch. And this couldn't have happened without either one of them. Of course, the network, The Horn, is of course sponsored by Cold River Mountain Watch at crmw.net, coldriverwind.org, and also brought along by the kind contributions of the listening audience who understand the viability of liberal radio. John Fox, is that you? John Fox, do it? Oh, darn it. Okay. Well, there we go again. Okay, so we're probably going to have that problem some more tonight. That's all right. Hold on. Just one second here. Okay, I have... let's see. John Fox, are you there?
I see an established, Bob.
All right. I've got your audio.
I don't hear an echo.
Okay.
But I don't hear you. I don't hear you. Check your mix minus, please.
That's what I'm going to do right now. My mix minus should be in pretty good shape, John. Okay, John, any difference?
I heard a poppy, funky.
Nothing going on there.
Cable.
Well, we're getting closer. For some reason or another,
Hello? No echo, Bob.
Okay, well, no, actually,
um...
I'm sitting here. This really is amazing. You know, we're teching with thousands upon thousands of miles away. I'm sitting here sending information to John, letting him try to diagnose the problem. Nick, work with me here for a second, please. That's going in. Okay, so this cable right here, see, make sure it's going into the hole that's blue. All right, John, has anything happening for you there?
So I heard that other pop, Bob.
Oh, rats. Okay. Yeah, John, I've changed some cabling here.
Still don't hear anything coming from you, whatever you're doing.
Okay, well, apparently we haven't quite sorted this out yet, but we will eventually in time. It's just kind of tough to do it on the fly. And, just to give you an idea of what it was like around here this afternoon, we got here in plenty of time to get stuff set up. However, we then had to wait for some infrastructure stuff, otherwise known as tables, to get brought along so that we could set up the rig. But at any rate, we'll be talking to a lot of the folks, several folks who are involved with this whole process here presently. And in the absence of telephones, let me suggest email. Let me suggest also the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room. Both are free and easy. To email me, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com, or to chat in the chat room, of course, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. BobKincaid@gmail.com or HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom, and we can certainly carry on the conversation that way. We will eventually sort this thing out. We're just not quite there yet. But that will happen. That will happen eventually. Let me take a minute and just see what's going on here. So we will we'll get our first conversation going here momentarily. Ah, yeah, okay, we could do that. All this at one time. Well, let's see. Okay. Well, before folks start showing up to join the conversation, there's certainly no harm in having a quick look at what in the world is going on in the world. That's what we do anyway. I really miss the telephones. Because this isn't nearly as much fun just, you know, babbling away my own little lonesome self. Yo, Nick.
Yes. Are we on?
You're about to be. My co-host for this trip, as well as partner in broadcast desperation, Nick Regalado, who's live blogging as we speak at headonradionetwork.com.
I am there.
While I've been babbling away, Nick, you've been working with the crowd. Who all are you talking to?
Oh, Bob, I've been talking to so many people that are here at the conference. People who are involved with, you know, all things green on all fronts and all levels, all angles. People doing things like trying to get people, ex-prisoners, into green jobs and creating green jobs and funding green projects. There's a lot of green going around here, man.
Yeah, it's a pretty green place. I haven't seen, you know, that's true. I haven't seen any fiends of coal hats or clean coal. They tried to talk a little bit of that stuff this morning, but not, you know, because there is an element. Oh yeah, no, we need to talk a little bit about what we saw this morning. There was some talk of carbon secret capture and sequestration, which, you know, pardon my non-scientific background, but just strikes me as a bunch of what's the word I'm looking for here, Nick?
Hooey?
Yeah, hooey. Bunk. Bunko. Hokum. Ain't gonna happen realistically on this planet in this world. Yeah, any of those things. So that, but there was an attempt to. I gotta tell you, the fact of the matter is, there are a lot of attempts to make things green here.
Absolutely, yeah.
Things that you wouldn't otherwise expect to be green. We saw a celebrity this morning.
We did.
We were within 25 feet or so of a real live, genuine, honest to goodness political celebrity.
Sure enough.
And what's the name of that organization? If you can find that bag, reach back there for a second. Let me get find it. I want to make sure I do this justice. Yeah, there they are. America's Ethanol Partners Growth Energy had a press conference today featuring none other than former General Wesley Clark. And they were putting on a press conference to announce that Wesley Clark was going to be their point man, announced as Growth Energy co-chairman. And I don't know how much that job pays, but they were at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference here. And they are saying that ethanol will, create thousands of green collar jobs. Nick, did that ring true with you?
You know, I'm still sorting out my feelings on that one, Bob. I don't know.
Yeah, it's bothersome. It's very much. I didn't stand up. I didn't stand up and be pain in the butt, Bob. I was tempted, but they got up, and this was the interesting part. They said that they had been challenging Big Food to stop lying about ethanol. And by that, you know, is this? I guess lying about ethanol, would that be pointing out the fact that a lot of people have taken to planting the price of corn's been driven up. The people are planting corn instead of, oh, I don't know. Let's see, in Mexico they tilled under some hundreds of years old agave fields that were used for tequila production. That'd break poor Bartok's heart. There was something about, let's see if I can find the statistic here, how they have reduced water, water waste, or water usage, and increased the yield of the corn in question. And you know how I feel about number two field grade Roundup Ready corn. You know, the stuff that you can boil for 8 days running and still break a tooth on.
Right.
And oh wow, Ferg's in the room.
Ferg
is in the house.
I'm gonna have to jump in the chat room now.
Hey Ferg.
Ferg dog. I called him that earlier. He didn't seem to like it.
Well, you know, he'll get over it. Hey, the answer's to Ferg. Hey, Ferg. Yes. No, I'm just saying hi, son. Just saying hi. Number two field grade corn is this genetically modified stuff. And it's made not to be corn. It's made to be a resource. It's where high fructose corn syrup comes from. It's where, you know, a lot of America's health problems come from. And if that's what they're using, then we're going to have a hard time saying that it's green. I'll defer to somebody else. John Fox, you're listening. If you're making something out of something that's genetically modified in the first place, can that be green? I'm just asking. If you're making the, but, and there was talk about, you know, cellulose-based ethanol and things like that as being, you know, something down the road. Corn cob, I guess we don't do anything with the corn cobs right now, do we?
You think we would be contemplating that aspect, huh?
No, but apparently we don't. Corn cob-based ethanol is something they say is in the future. Cellulose-based ethanol is something that they say is in the future. One of the things that apparently they wanted was for the federal government to relax the standards for blending of ethanol into gasoline, saying that it yields gallon for gallon a 50% reduction in greenhouse gases. And, you know, like I said, there's a lot of good stuff, a lot of really great ideas going on here. I was not inclined to just bite on that. Made me a little bit leery. So that was our brush with greatness. Now, something that was slightly more inspiring took place shortly thereafter. We also attended a press conference featuring AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, who was talking about the creation of a green jobs-based institute. Was that the gist of it, Nick?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
And it was going to be funded by the AFL-CIO. AFL-CIO, I just stepped on my own toe. It's a little hairy around here. To foster green practices among organized labor. And that's the kind of synergistic relationship that you've got to have if we're going to accomplish what it is that a lot of these folks are setting out to do. One of the things that... One of the things that I would simply love to do is to take our cell phone device,
right,
and march my happy butt into the reception in there, but we don't have that going yet. We've got to get the cell phone going out of here and over to here, and the funny thing is we've got... Yeah, that's cool. I got this part. But it can't hear... can't hear me yet. And I find that odd. Try something here. I tell you what, give me a minute. We're gonna do a little tech-alizing before we get some folks back here behind the microphone. Let's see. What do we want? What would be a good sound for this program? Okay, everything's working. All right, let's see. Oh, here we go.
You will linger.
There we go. Be right back.
Linger there for hours.
For the ages, what's going on with my rap pages? Rappers wanna be down, but listen. You got to feel it within your body and your spirit when you listen to the rhythm. Come on, it's the abstract, rulers on the beat, women all around the globe, the world. You gotta follow me, changing history, categories, different people in the same territories. Hip hop in the form of black eyed peas, watch it
be mindful of the speakers, please, cause they gon' rumble and shake the ground. Break atoms, break the sound, cause the end base profound. Streams make the things profound. If you wanna do to help you out, make it cool around your friends without smoking out. Play the song kinda loud, it can help you out. And you can work it out, and you can work it out. It's like that, and we got it like that. You know we got it like that. Yeah, we got it like that. It's like that, like that. Yeah, we got it like that. You know we got it like that. Yeah, we got it like that. It's like that, cause I got it like that. And I got it like that also. Got a style that's way out like Boston. You know I'm known to cook a nigga like Choco. Steady dropping rhymes like it's heavy cargo. Yup, really far though. From El Segundo to Toronto. I once hit a girl up in Chicago, but I never say no unless my name was Tonto. Yup, you know how the date rate go. Cold we show the class.
Uptown, it's murder all in the street. Uptown, it's murder out in the street. That's where I found my magic wand. Most every night. Since May, there's trouble. Most every night. Where once we danced our sweet routine, it leads to wine and kerosene. And now I'll break and join.
So here's the temporary plan for the moment. I've got this crazy idea that I want to get this X-Lite phone cooking. So I'm going to stop the stream. Okay, I'm going to stop the stream for just a minute. We will revert to White Rose music. Okay, hold on a minute. Question from the boy. Yeah, Ferg. I'm going to stop the stream for just a minute and then see if I can get the X-Lite cooking. And if we can do that, we'll, and that's the soft, never mind. That's the technology we use. At any rate, get that going, and then I will also, and then I'll get back to this. So stand by, please. Thank you.
Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
The change? You are the change. And that's correct. And that's what I'm saying to the good folks here, but whether you're environmentalists, entrepreneurs, labor union people, whatever, that we have to be the force that makes the difference. And the difference is that for the last 30 years, we've not been able to get inside. You know, even in the Clinton administration, we got, you know, some token things thrown at us. But the real change now is that the White House door is open. I think the congressional door is open as well. And they're saying, okay, come make us do something. And so it's incumbent on us to be the difference.
It's reminiscent, isn't it, Jim, of the that old line from FDR, where he said, I like what you're doing, I want to do what you're doing, now make me do it.
Precisely.
Do we have a chance through movements like this to...
This is the only chance we have, is through movements. That's how progressives make any difference in America, is when we organize at the grassroots level and bring our country power into our countryside power. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm including, I don't mean just the rural areas,
I mean,
the cities as well, and come inside with our force, and that produces the change. Nobody inside, whether it's a president or a governor or a senator or whoever, can make the difference. It has to come from the outside, because the inside power, there are 13,000 corporate lobbyists in this city, in Washington, D.C.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. And now they're not on our side.
No.
And we have a recalcitrant, knuckle-dragging bunch of Neanderthal Republicans who want to stand in the way. I'm not saying all of them, but I'm just saying leadership here in Washington, in the Congress, that just wants to say no. Well, that's not what America wants to hear. America voted for change, and they mean it even bolder, I think, than Obama thinks they do. America wants real change, and that is only going to come by these kind of coalitions of workers with environmentalists, and I'd say also with farmers. I was just out in Iowa with a group called the American Corn Growers Association, and they are totally on to this environmental program, not just about ethanol and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but wind energy, solar energy, all of that. They see the future, and they want to be a part of this change, and that's the only thing that makes the change, is when people want to make it themselves.
Well, let me ask you about a specific topic, because just to put a little prologue on everything.
Sure.
I have followed your career for quite some time, read your books.
You're the one.
Yeah, I
wondered.
I've got two.
Okay.
But also ran your commentaries on our program, on our radio network.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you.
And you're a point of inspiration for the idea that there can be liberal talk radio.
Oh, yeah.
That there are people out there that want to have these conversations. That's why we talk with working folks every day.
Exactly.
and have extended long-form conversations. With that in mind, the whole operation was formed as a partnership between environmental activists and labor activists in West Virginia.
Right.
And I wanted to take a moment, first of all, to thank you for speaking out so broadly, so boldly, and so profoundly on the issue of mountain removal.
Oh. This is so atrocious. I just almost upchuck, you know,
yeah.
every time I think about it, about what's happening to these ancient mountains and these people, you know. It's just a crime. And I think the more people know it, they hear it from you, they go on the websites of the great mountain organizations, and they see what's actually happening. Because a lot of people can't believe it's actually happening. I've had people send me emails and said, well, I talked to somebody and they said, this isn't happening. They're not doing that. And I said, well, here's the website. You go look at it yourself, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. We're sponsored. The network is sponsored by Coal River Mountain Watch.
Oh, which fabulous. Is one of the great ones, yeah.
One of the questions that I've been asking while I've been here, as we look at this nexus between labor and environmental issues, is how do we get the green jobs into Appalachia? Because until we replace those jobs blowing up mountains with something viable,
totally.
How can we expect to green that area?
And of course, blowing up mountains means less jobs, even
yes.
in coal. But yes, absolutely. And this has to be a priority. And I'm pushing this, and I think this group has to go to Obama and to the Congress and say, this is not just about the cities. This is not just about cars. This is about the countryside of America, really the grassroots. The rural communities have a huge role to play all across the country, but certainly in Appalachia. I mean, we've talked, in my state of Texas, the poorest area of our state is down in South Texas in what are called colonias, unincorporated areas that don't have water, they don't have sewer. And we've talked about this for generations, not just decades, generations. And it's time to do something about it. And here's a chance, because whether it's wind energy, solar energy, the internet infrastructure of rural America,
right.
All of that has to be, everybody doesn't have to go to the city, That's the change. We have to just admit that, and make that a point
of
our policy.
Yeah, there's a place for everything. Let me make sure that you don't leave without one of these.
All right. That's Cold River Wind.
That's one of the
things. For any wind.
That's one of the biggest projects we've got going on right now, Jim. The Cold River Mountain sits in the heart of the Appalachian coal fields, and it is it is slated for destruction.
Yeah.
Frankly,
yeah.
It'll destroy the community. It'll destroy the region when it goes.
But
we have a viable plan put forward for a massive wind farm that can provide good jobs in perpetuity, 200,000 houses worth of electricity, as opposed to blowing up the mountain. Now the problem, I think you were the first person to coin the term Congress critter.
Yeah.
I got some Congress critters.
Yeah, you do.
and that's a question for populists and activists, is how do you get past the absolute blinding amounts of money that are involved in making because that's what we face in West Virginia, in our congressional delegation.
Yeah.
They get beaten over the head with, but we're bringing jobs.
Yeah, right. And now people, I think, are more and more people are realizing they're not bringing jobs, and they're bringing low wage jobs, and in fact things like wind energy and other true grassroots economic development, not tinkle down economics, but percolate up economics,
right.
Is our future. And so we just have to keep pushing. We have to keep pushing with our ideas and our ideals. And we also have to push some reforms. A number of states now are doing public financing of their elections. Maine, mm-hmm. North Carolina, and some of their elections.
We're trying to move it in West Virginia.
Arizona,
as well.
Other. This is a huge change. In Maine now, they have 83% of their Senate and 84% of their House elected without ever taking a dime in corporate money, because public financing is available. That alternative is available to them. And Republicans do it as well as Democrats. Greens do it.
And it makes a vastly larger amount, a larger general population of brains you can have in
exactly.
Okay, one last thing before you go, because I know you're a little pressed for time, and I really appreciate you taking time.
Oh, it's a joy. Thank you.
Now, I'm from West Virginia, but I was born and raised in Alabama. I'm a Southerner.
That's all right.
Yeah, we'll get over
it's okay.
It. Yeah, you're a Texan. How do we take that next step to reclaim the South for liberal values, progressive ideas?
Incremental. We keep pushing those values: economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunity for all people. The populist movement in the 1800s came out of the South.
Yes, it did.
It came out of Texas. It moved up the Plain State. It moved into the upper Midwest, but it came out of the South. That's who people are. Our political spectrum is not right to left. It's top to bottom. That's where right to left is theory. It's ideology. Top to bottom is experience. That's what people are experiencing in Appalachia with mountaintop removal,
exactly.
and any number of other issues. And so we have to recognize that people are not necessarily liberal or conservative. They want common sense, and they want the common good. And we've got to get back to that concept.
There's no such thing as conservative cornflakes or liberal beans and cornbread.
Right. And push that and put candidates up. In Texas now, we have 150 member House of Representatives, and we now have 76 Democrats and 76 Republicans, 74 Democrats. So we've been gaining even in that state. Dallas County, which has been a hotbed, that's where George Bush is moving back to, not
right.
to that little ranch yet he had down there in Crawford.
Yeah,
he's not going
there.
He's going to Dallas. So that county now has every county county office holder, from sheriff through all the county judges, were all Republican until 2006 when they all became Democrats, because we mounted a grassroots campaign. And that's what the Democratic Party or the Progressive Party, whatever it is called, has got to go to the people again. Get out of this notion that we can just raise money from corporations and kiss their butts and somehow or other compete. That's not a competition. We've got to compete on the basis of our ideas and our values and go to the people with those. And it's even in Dallas County, that has shown that you can make it happen.
Well, and when that can happen there,
yeah,
it can happen
there
anyway.
You go.
Jim Hightower.
Thank you.
Thank you very
pleasure
much.
To be with
it's
you.
A pleasure to meet you, sir.
Keep kicking.
We're going to try.
Right.
You do the same. Right. Progressive icon Jim Hightower dropping by the table. Kelly, you're wonderful. Through the efforts of Blue-Green Alliance Communications Director Kelly Schwinghammer. Yeah, let's get Bill over here and get some stuff cooking. We're going to talk next with West Virginia's Sierra Club Representative Bill Price. He will be here momentarily to talk about a lot of this. All right, sidle on up to the microphone, Bill. Thanks for taking time to talk with us. You're the West Virginia coordinator for the Sierra Club.
Well, I actually work for the Environmental Justice Program in Central Appalachia. I'm based in Charleston, but I have states other than West Virginia.
Oh, okay. So, Sierra Club, and when did the idea of environmental justice sort of begin to get traction in Appalachia?
Oh, in Appalachia, probably in the late 1990s. In regards to this Sierra Club program, we started 6 years ago, working out of my home with area groups like Cold River Mountain Watch, mm-hmm. OVAC, those. There's been people working on environmental justice for many years.
Right, on their own.
On their own, yeah.
Well, of course, first of all, I am really grateful to be here. As a function of the Sierra Club's sponsorship of the West Virginia delegation, and as a statement of general policy, what does the Sierra Club see for a future, a non-coal-based future in West Virginia?
Well, we think that that's going to be driven by the communities. What we want to see is everybody agrees that there's going to be a post-coal economy. Coal is going to go away. Whether or not it goes away in 5 years or 15 years is up for debate and many discussions, but everybody agrees that we're going to have to work to do something post-coal. That includes a jobs program that has good union-organized, sustainable jobs in areas of the state and in areas of Appalachia that traditionally, because they've been dependent mostly on the coal industry, have not been good economic areas. So, but we think that what we need, first of all, is to have a series of visioning meetings, getting input from the communities that says, this is what we want our community to look like once coal has gone away. We also think that the coal industry restricts economic development in those areas because mountaintop removal destroys resources. Nobody's going to put a plant where they can't drink the water, those types of things. So we think that we need an immediate cease of mountaintop removal and other irresponsible coal mining areas or coal mining methods before we can see true economic prosperity.
Bill, you just hit a really big one, and that is when you said nobody's going to come in and build a plant where they can't have a decent lifestyle for their workers and their workers' families. Is it as simple as what I've argued that, you know, you got to end the mountaintop removal before, or the I've dropped the top. It's just mountain removal to me now, Bill. Is that the sine qua non? Is that nothing else can happen until we get that ended? Or is there any way to start building in this this idea of green jobs and this nexus between labor and environmental practice?
Oh, I think there are things that we can do. I just think that when you start talking about economic development in the coal fields, I'll take, for instance, the Cove River Mountain Wind Project. You know, if they remove Cove River Mountain, if they totally blow it to bits, that takes away the potential of having the Cove River Mountain Wind Project. They can still mine the coal in traditional underground methods and still have the wind farm. But that's an example of a clear choice. Blow up the mountain, save the mountain, and have another economic opportunity. And we feel that, you know, we can save the mountain, still mine a certain amount of coal off of it through traditional underground methods, and have economic development. To do that, you wouldn't have to ban mountaintop removal, but in the long run, and in the midterm, mountaintop removal's got to end if we're going to have true economic prosperity, because it's not bringing the jobs to the areas that it's blowing up. And we've got to stop that. We can have these visioning meetings, we can talk about things like that, and we can have wind projects and solar projects and things like that. But we are, you know, in the midterm, we have got to stop mountaintop removal coal mining for there to be true sustainable economic development in Appalachia.
Now, politics. We have political problems in West Virginia, and political problems, generally speaking, in Appalachia, in terms of people who elected representatives who listen to everybody, well, not everybody, but they don't listen to affected community residents. They don't listen when we talk about what happens to the water up Predator Holler. They don't listen when we talk about the health problems, the poisons getting into streams. They listen to the coal industry. Is it merely a matter of we keep hammering at them even though they keep ignoring us, or do we start looking for people to replace them?
We start looking for people to replace them. But we need to do that in a way. I mean, political organizing is one aspect of the organizing, on-the-ground organizing, that is just beginning to get off the ground here in Appalachia. You know, there's a tradition in Appalachia that if you are elected to, for instance, the House of Representatives, let's just take a Nick Joe Rahal, you know, that Nick Joe feels like he can, you know, he's entitled to that seat for the rest of his life unless he decides he wants to run for something else.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, some of the voters in the southern part of West Virginia feel that same way. And there needs to be this change of attitude and a realization that if Nick Joe Rahal is not doing what we want him to do, continues to think the old way, then he needs to go. And we need to organize politically on the ground, get lots of people that will vote for an alternative, and go out and get those alternative people.
Now, let's talk just a minute specifically about Congressman Rahal, because you're well aware of what's going on, the mountain removal job that's going on up on Gauley Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Now that sits in the middle of an area. It's the part they're blowing up isn't protected yet, of course, but it sits in the middle of the new and Gauley River National Recreation Area. It's something that I would think would be near and dear to the Sierra Club's heart. Because it's a sustainable means of enjoying profound natural wonder. Nick's on the horns of a dilemma here, isn't he? Because he was part and parcel of the creation of that park, if I understand correctly.
He was.
And yet he doesn't like to say boo when it comes to a mountaintop removal job. But aren't those two things finally in direct conflict, Bill?
Yeah. Nick Joe Rahal is going to have to make a decision.
He's got to choose.
He can choose the old way of doing things, you know, where he was, you know, bought and paid for by the coal industry and, you know, still continue to think that the coal industry is the greatest thing in West Virginia, or he can change and say, I will listen to the people, the common person, and realize that this isn't working. And so, and it's not sustainable to blow up Gali Mountain, and it's, you know, it's crazy. It's stupid. It's stupid to think that you can blow up a mountain that's next to the, you know, this world's oldest, second oldest river,
right?
And say that's okay.
Yeah.
And so Nicky Joe needs to realize that if he continues to decide the wrong way, then the people of West Virginia are going to get fed up, and they're going to go after him.
Does he have, what we've been told is that he would like to see the federal government buy up all that land and include it in the Gali River National Recreation Area. Is there even a remote chance, in your opinion, of that happening?
I don't know. Maybe. I doubt seriously that that's going to happen, but it's certainly not going to happen if they blow it up.
Well, have you ever known of a land company selling the land for less than they can get for exploiting the coal in it?
Well, and that's a whole other issue with the absentee land ownership. So, I would imagine that the federal government is going to come in and buy up that land. They're going to have to use power that the federal government can use in order to say to the landowner, you're going to give us this land because it's for a higher and better use.
Almost an eminent domain kind of
situation? That's basically what it is, an eminent domain.
Wouldn't
it be great for the federal government to use the power of eminent domain for a good purpose rather than for a bad purpose?
And get it right for a change? Absolutely. Of course, you know, given the economic times that we're in right now, I look at that and I think, where's the money going to come from do that?
Whether or not the federal government comes in and buys up the land or not, that's the issue is Gali Mountain needs to be protected.
Yes.
Yeah, Gali Mountain is pictured on the quarter of West Virginia. You know, we shouldn't be blowing up the mountain. It's on the quarter. Otherwise, we're going to have to change the quarter.
Right, exactly. In fact, we were talking earlier today, and if you're driving across the New River Gorge Bridge and you look over at that view, you can see that you can tell just looking at it, especially with the leaves down and everything, that something funny is going on back there because mountains, they have an essence to them, and it's sort of barren and creepy looking back behind it. We came up with a novel new way of thinking about it. It's a scenic mountain Potemkin village. if you know what I'm talking about, because I've been up there, and back behind that immediate ridge that you can see from the bridge, back behind it, dead zone, moonscape. And the speed with which they can accomplish this stuff, because remember the Gali Mountain job, they started without a permit and did it anyway, because you know it's West Virginia and you know you got dynamite, got coal mine, and from November 2007 to November 2008, they completely moonscaped that entire area. I mean, they can do this in a hurry.
Well, and there's two things that, first of all, the coal industry is having a hard time hiding this from the general public anymore for two reasons. Number one is the jobs and the scope of the jobs are getting so big that they can no longer keep it behind the ridges, behind that first line of ridges. The second reason that they're having a hard time hiding this is just the stubbornness of the residents and the strategic way that the residents go out all over the country and tell people in Boston and in New York City and here in Washington, D.C., what's going on. And there's nobody that I talk to or that after they've seen this up close and personal, after they've seen Mountaintop and we were up close and personal, to go, oh, that's okay. Yeah, that's a great, that's okay. I mean, you hear just today in one of the workshops on that was here at the Blue Green Alliance, you know, someone flashed a picture of Mountaintop and Moo One in the back of the room. You can hear that. I can't believe that. You know, and then you talk to them about it, and they go, well, that can't happen.
That's got
to
be illegal.
That's got to be illegal. And it is illegal.
Well, it is, and if it was being done in Oregon, it wouldn't be being done.
Right.
If it was being done, if they were trying to do it in New York or Vermont, it wouldn't be being done. Mm-hmm. It's a function of that nexus between the bought-out political systems, a terrified populace, because, you know, I mean, look, here I sit. Dad was a miner. Granddad was a miner. All my uncles were miners. My great-grandfather and all my granduncles were miners. Coal creates that mindset where, well, you know, well, you better go on into the mine, son. There ain't going to be no other jobs
for
you.
Yeah, but the concept of that is, you know, my father was a miner also.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this isn't the coal mining of your grandfather or my father.
No, it did not.
This is not moving pillar with a pick and shovel. This is just total destruction of an ecosystem, and it's got to stop. And the coal industry, I think, is basically grasping at straws here. You know, they're trying to get the last lumps of coal from Appalachia before they're going away. And the decisions are being made at the national level that are creating a lot of frightening ideals coming from the coal industry. They see their industry on the way out, but they're trying to grasp to those final straws.
Well, once they've picked their bones clean, Bill, and they've gone their merry way, what happens when a dam bursts? What happens when Kingston, Tennessee happens in Boone County, West Virginia? Who's going to clean up that mess then?
Well, we've got to stop the Kingstons from happening. We've got to stop the mountains from being blown up. We've got to stop the industry from looking at other technologies like coal to liquid, which is just big.
We haven't even touched on that yet.
Yeah, we're going to talk about coal to liquid plants here in Mingo County that they're proposing, and they've got one over in Ohio that they're proposing. This is the industry's way of saying, okay, well, we can see where we may have some issues now with electrical generation, so let's frame this as being a homeland security issue. And, you know, we all know we need to be less dependent upon foreign oil, and coal is the answer for that, which is basically bull. You know, coal to liquid doesn't work. It's extremely polluting. If the industry
doesn't it take more water in the end than the fuel it puts out?
It takes an extreme amount of water, and Naki will tell you more about that when he's got all the facts and figures. I will just say this. Coal to liquid is the coal industry's way of trying to survive, because they see the electric generation through conservation and through efficiency. They're not going to have that market anymore. There's going to be a tax on carbon that's going to come down. And they see a way of saying, this is a way we can open up a new market. The thing is, it's extremely polluting. Even if you were somehow able to capture the carbon and put it underground and keep the earth from burping it back up, then you would still have the tailpipe emissions coming from this stuff.
Sure.
This is not economically feasible. It's a stupid ideal. It's an ideal that the coal industry has come up with to try to save their butts. And, I hope that people in Mingo County understand that this is a false promise, and that they need, for true economic development, they need to get together, support things like sustainable wind in their community, solar panels. You know, we can have true economic prosperity, but we've got to quit listening to the false promises of the coal industry to get that.
Well, Bill, I tell you what, you're doing a great job, and I thank you for taking time to come by and let us, you know, share a few ideas with us, because what we've done here with the Horn is to expand, you know, consciousness to a lot of those same people who initially said, what? No, that can't, and they've learned that it is. And hearing somebody who's on the ground out there working the issues is very, very important. One last question. How do you bring the next generation along? How can we get this concept of environmental justice into the schools, into public education somehow?
I think the next generation is going to bring us along. I look at the young people that are here at this conference. I look at the young people that are getting involved in the mountaintop removal movement, getting involved in just this whole environmental justice movement. You know, they're the future, and they're going to bring us along. They're probably going to kick our butts, and that's fine with me.
They can look back at folks like you and said, and you know, they weren't sitting on their butts. Mm-hmm. They were trying.
I just want to say one thing about the Blue Green Alliance conference that we're sitting at, and I think it is a key element of the work for economic justice and for environmental justice in the Appalachian coalfields, for us to be able to talk to the labor movement.
Yes.
We're not going to agree on everything, but we're going to talk to them about what we can agree on, and together we can move forward, because, you know, they want some of the same things we want. They want a good paying job. We want good paying jobs for our communities. They want union organized jobs. We want union organized jobs for our communities. We may disagree on how to get there, but the bottom line is that we agree on more than what we disagree on. And these kinds of conferences are an opportunity for us to get to know each other, get to talking to each other, see where we can support each other's
Have you seen stuff. That dialogue taking place these last couple of days?
I actually have. I mean, we had a rally up on the Hill yesterday in support of the Employee Free Choice Act. Sierra Club spoke at that. We had a lot of members up there for that. You know, there are things that we can work on together. We'll have to work out the things we don't quite agree on, but there are things we can work on together. And let me tell you, when the labor movement and the environmental movement join hands together and start walking down the halls of Congress together,
hallelujah,
Katie,
amen.
Katie bar the door, that's going to put some fear of God in a lot of folk up on the Hill.
And it's fear they've earned.
Yes.
Is this sort of thing going to be a continuing effect? I mean, I guess last year this conference was in Pittsburgh. Is it going to be possible to build on, continue this coalition building then, between labor, between environmental, organizations? You mentioned employee free choice. That's among the linchpins, I think, as far as real progress is concerned for working families in America, in the first year of, President Obama's administration. Is there a real presence out there in the environmental community pushing for that as well?
Yeah, I think the Sierra Club has formally endorsed the Employee Free Choice Act. We're pushing on that. I think other environmental groups are doing the same thing. I do think, and the Pittsburgh conference last year was the first one. This one here is the second one. And what I hear is that coming out of these conferences is the opportunity to go back to West Virginia, go back to Ohio, go back to Pennsylvania, and actually build on the relationships that are started here and start doing some grassroots level work with the steelworkers, with the laborers unions, and environmental groups in the community.
Yeah, because you talk about the things that we can agree on, that, you know, having the building trades out there taking the lead on, for instance, green construction practices, energy efficiency, and making that part of something that they advocate for in terms of the jobs that they seek. We can't do that for them. That's something that only labor can bring in on its own initiative. Do you sense that groundwork has been laid?
I think the groundwork has been laid. Yeah. I think that, you know, last year there was a lot, some suspicion between the two camps, and it was like, okay, how are we going to, you know, we sort of, it's like a dance, you know, you kind of get to know each other. This year the relationships are a lot better. The conference is going very smooth, in my opinion. The workshops have been interesting. Yeah, there's been some issues, but, you know, there's always going to be issues.
Yeah, we had the little carbon sequestration.
Yeah, the little carbon sequestration thing. And then this afternoon there was a carbon sequestration thing the other way, you know.
Yeah, reality check.
One of my favorite quotes came out of the Pittsburgh conference. Actually, Carl Pope from the Sierra Club said, you know, if you're looking to build an alliance and you look around the room and you are comfortable with everybody that's in the room, you don't have a big enough alliance.
Amen to that. Bill Price, thank you very much. And thanks for everything you've done to make all of this possible.
Thank you for being here and for spreading the word all over the country.
You know what? We'll go anywhere anybody will have us.
All right.
Take care. Bill Price, Environmental Justice Coordinator at the Sierra Club. Come on around. Just don't let me trip you with my wires.
Hi.
Hi. Just kind of get up on the mic so we can hear you real good.
Sure.
If you don't mind, just give me a little lowdown, who, what, why, when, where.
Sure. My name is Nahi. I work for Sierra Club in Ohio.
Okay.
We work in Ohio to move Ohio beyond coal, basically. Ohio's been reliant on coal for a long time and still is. 90% of our electricity comes from coal.
Sure.
And West Virginia. You know this very well. One of our main priorities here and at the Blue Gate Alliance as well is to approach our politicians and say that we are failing our workforce, we are failing our workers and Ohioans in general if we continue to stick to ways of the past. The state of Ohio has this very unfortunate habit of being behind the curve on a lot of things. 100 years ago, we were behind the curve on pottery. We relied on the pottery industry to prop up a lot of our economic activity, especially in northern and eastern Ohio. And then the rest of the country moved on, and we were left with a lot of empty pottery factories. And then same thing happened with steel. And the same thing is happening with coal. The rest of the country is moving beyond it inexorably. We have politicians, elected officials, and leaders of all sorts who are saying we have to stick to this, and the fact is we have to move beyond it.
So you're working there in a state with a rather, shall we say, conservative tradition especially southern Ohio, places like that.
Sure, with a small C. I mean, the old habits die hard, and sometimes old habits are good.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes old habits
are
bad.
In other words, stodgy. but you know, this is the state of the Tafts and the Hardings and the Hoovers and. How are you moving into individual outreach to get people the message? Is this door knocking stuff? I mean, how do you put the light on for folks there? I mean, I live in West Virginia. I hear the explosions. It's easy for me.
Sure.
But somebody who's got a more attenuated relationship between the light switch and the explosions in Appalachia, how do you make it real for them?
Well, one of the really powerful things I've been witnessing recently is that people have this very deep ingrained sense now that something is very wrong. Something is very wrong and it's affecting everything. And because it's affecting everything, it must be systemic. And so a lot of our work is being done by the very grave problems that are facing us economically, socially, and environmentally. And people without even having an environmental background or having a previous experience with these issues are saying, wait, there is something weird going on with our environment. There's something weird going on with our climate. I feel wrong somehow, and they're reaching out to us. Sierra Club, in general, is, I think, one of Ohio's, our bigger organizations. We have a more powerful voice in the media, and we do get our message out in traditional ways, but more and more we're seeing that people are coming to us with concerns and people who never would have come to us before.
And when they do come to you, I mean, what do you tell them? What is the future you envision?
Specifically, the first thing we have to do to move beyond coal, and we do have to move beyond coal, is to get our efficiency in order, because we waste so much energy in Ohio, from the transmission lines that carry electricity to the people at home who use inefficient appliances or who let it out through their windows or through their uninsulated homes. We have now a very strong energy efficiency bill in Ohio that mandates a 22% reduction in demand by 2025. But that's not enough. We need to do more. It's a very powerful bill. We're excited about it, but we need to go beyond that. We need to do a lot of work on efficiency, and that's also the fastest, cheapest, and cleanest way to clean up.
When you talk about the inefficiencies of the grid, Nachi, are we talking about a rebuilding of the grid or a re-examination of it? Or are we talking about less centralization? In the best of all possible worlds, how would you re-envision power delivery in a state like Ohio?
That gets really controversial, and Sierra Club doesn't have a stated position on that, because we recognize that there are a lot of things involved. A total redoing of the grid involves some very tricky land issues, as I'm sure you're aware. We don't want to be advocating eminent domain, especially in communities that we're trying to protect from other sort of oppressive and high-handed actions.
Right.
There's that. On the other hand, there is a dreadful need for a reimagining of the way we distribute electricity, and so maybe one of those ways is decentralization. Moving toward more local generation will reduce line loss, and also, because local generation has to be cleaner, otherwise people will object, that will also lead to greater efficiency as well.
Okay. What about these alternative energy sources? A lot of talk here about wind, a lot of talk here about solar. Is that an idea? You know, Ohio has been absolutely bled out of jobs. Is the idea of solar and of wind and the industrial or employment opportunities that come with that, is that something that's getting more traction?
Well, people always tell me, you know, Ohio doesn't have any wind and solar. Germany is the world's leading country in solar power, and we have more solar than Germany does. Germany is a pretty pale state in comparison to most of the United States, and including Ohio. But the most job-intensive parts of renewable energies are in the manufacturing, and that's where Ohio has always shined. So in the 8,000 parts that make up a wind turbine, Ohio steelworkers should be playing a huge role in that, whether we put up the wind turbines in Ohio or not.
Right, in the construction phase.
And that's where, I mean, when you're talking about the job-intensive components of the new energy future, that's what we are looking at in Ohio.
Well, I'm looking at the headonradionetwork.com chat room right now, and I've got a reminder coming in from one of our chat room moderators who lives in central Ohio, who says, remember, the blackout of 2003 was caused by a grid failure in Ohio.
That's right.
So it's something that is very much a forefront issue for Ohio. I've got a question coming in from from our chief engineer and webmaster, who's in Sydney, Australia. That's the beauty of this technology.
It's amazing.
We're real time with our chief engineer. He's been teching with me all evening here. Can't do that with a radio signal. He wants to know your thoughts. He's saying here, solar geothermal baseload. Now it's being done. Are you familiar with any of that technology?
That's right. Well, solar power in Wisconsin. Sorry, you said solar and geothermal.
Solar geothermal together. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the specifics of it. Solar. Any kind of baseload technology. First of all, I should say that when I was talking about efficiency acts as baseload generation. It acts as if you are relieving any baseload strain that you're putting on your grid. Solar is being done in Wisconsin. A utility is looking at solar because they know that they can't. This is viable. This is a viable way to meet their demand. Solar geothermal. I'm not entirely familiar with. It's crossed my path a few times.
John describes it, it involves pressure storage to run at night, so that you've actually got a 24-hour energy cycle. He's talked
Makes
about
sense.
It a great deal on his program. It's being done in other parts of the world. Were you present for the afternoon plenary session with, Debbie Stabenow, or early, well, mid-morning, with Debbie Stabenow and Amy Klobuchar?
I was.
What did you hear Senator Klobuchar's story about the little phone company in northern Minnesota that was greening up its customers for nothing more than emergency backup for power loss?
Huh.
Fascinating story of this is not one of the monster telecoms. It's just a local affair, but they were offering long-term financing for folks to have wind and solar that would provide emergency power backup for them in the event of rather frequent power losses. Is that something that Sierra is interested in terms of or where does the Sierra Club stand in terms of bringing federal leveraging into making these technologies available on a house by house or on a consumer basis? Whether it be a tax credit, a tax incentive, or something that will get people actually paying attention to where their electricity comes from and perhaps generating some of their own.
I think we would be very much in support. The federal government has such a huge role to play, and one of the points we're trying to make clear is that the federal government currently has this silver buckshot approach, right? No silver bullet, but the more bullets we can throw at the problem, the more likely one of them is going to hit, or more than one is going to hit. We would say, rather than these technologies we know are old and dirty and have stopped working, rather than subsidizing those, as we still do very much with oil and coal and other fossil fuels, let's throw all that money. There's only a limited pot. Let's throw all of that money towards solar and wind. Really use the silver buckshot toward the technologies we know are effective and will protect us.
Well, if you'd like to lean over here, this is what John Fox was talking about, and I knew this was the acronym for it. SHPEGS, Solar Heat Pump Electrical Generation System, so that it's a symbiotic process whereby you use your solar and your wind and your geothermal in order to create a constant, because that's always the knock, is that, well, the sun doesn't shine at night and the wind doesn't always blow.
Very cool. Yeah, very, very much so. When someone says the word dispatchability to me, I always want to cringe, because we're smart. We know how to diversify. We know how to make hybrid renewable sources. Right, so the sun doesn't always blow, but at night when the sun doesn't, sorry, the sun doesn't always shine, but at night when the sun doesn't shine, the wind is blowing the hardest. And when we have natural gas for peaking capacity if we have to. And this is another example of a way we can combine renewable technologies that by themselves may not be very dispatchable, but together provide 100% dispatchability, 100% reliability, and can provide baseload generation very, very capably.
Now, General Wesley Clark was here earlier today announcing, they were announcing his co-chairmanship of this growth energy ethanol company. Where does Sierra stand on the ethanol issue? Because it's not clear cut, and
no.
I worry about whether it's green or greenwashed, frankly.
Right. Sierra Club is not really supporting corn-based ethanol. We don't feel it's energy positive. We don't feel this is an improvement over the energy process that it takes to process gasoline. We also don't want to see food being turned into a fuel product. We saw what happened to food prices several months ago. There was that huge spike and caused a lot of hardship. Not just in the U.S. but worldwide. We believe that the future of transportation really lies in the plug-in hybrid, but that's true only if we manage to move away from coal as a source of energy, as a source of electricity for the plug-in hybrid.
So then, as you do your work in Ohio, do you have active? I mean, for instance, in West Virginia, we talk about the fact that there's no such thing as clean coal. We talk about all the harmful effects of mountaintop removal, all that sort of thing, and we constantly have thrown at us, you know, the coal industry will spend boatloads of money to try to scream down whatever common sense we're putting out there.
Sure.
Do you face that kind of thing at your end of the spectrum? I mean, are there industries that are aligning against you to try to prevent this contemplation and movement toward a green energy tomorrow?
All the time. You know, we're fighting this liquid coal plant in Ohio.
Okay, we got to talk about that. Yeah. Where's this set to be built?
It's in Columbiana County. It's about, if you imagine Ohio as a clock, it's about 2:30.
Okay.
And right where Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia meet, right at the top of the Ohio River as
okay,
it comes
yeah.
into Ohio. And the name of this plant is Ohio River Clean Fuels. This is the line they're going with. I think they genuinely consider themselves to be a green energy company, even though they're...
Oh, they got a lot of nerve.
Well, you know, they do. They actually are in position now to single-handedly increase Ohio's carbon emissions by 10%. That's the size of the plant they want to build. It'll burn 20,000 tons of coal every day.
Ouch.
And, yeah, 120 rail cars or so every day. That's not acceptable. And Bill earlier mentioned the water issue, or you mentioned the water issue, actually. 23 million gallons a day out of the Ohio River and only 10 million back.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. This was permitted, by the way, by the Ohio EPA.
So where does the wastewater go?
Atmosphere.
So when the wastewater goes into the atmosphere, isn't it going as steam?
Mm-hmm.
And being as how it's going up as steam, isn't that warmer than the atmosphere it's going into?
That's true.
Isn't this a warming issue? I mean,
just because carbon
doesn't mean that it's not a warming issue.
That's true. As far as I'm aware, there's some scientific debate as to whether or not to classify water vapor itself as a greenhouse gas. If you do, it's more potent than carbon dioxide or even methane. The straight warming potential of water vapor, of H2O, is very, it traps a lot of heat. But some scientists say, well, no, water vapor, you know, it comes out of the atmosphere in 3 days, so it's not really a greenhouse gas. But either way, yes, it's warming the atmosphere.
Wait, stop. Sorry. It comes out of the atmosphere in 3 days in the form of rain?
Rain, yeah.
And this coal to liquids plant is going to make what guarantee that there aren't? I mean, I know. Come on, coal is filthy with mercury.
Yes.
Are they saying that none of that particulate matter is going to go up in? They're willing to guarantee that. I mean, this is astonishing.
Wow.
The particulate matter, we're very worried about the particulate matter because the plant is built on the border of Columbiana and Jefferson County. Jefferson County, home of Steubenville, home of traditionally really, really troubled air quality and environmental justice communities. So the Ohio EPA, in response to that claim, said, well, the plant is only bordering Jefferson County, so clearly none of the pollutants are actually going to go into Jefferson County, so that's not a worry for us. But, yeah, we are raising these issues.
Logic takes a beating sometimes.
We are raising these issues, and we're thankful, actually, that the investment community is looking at this largely with amusement. You know, a $6 billion plant with speculative technology in the middle of a credit crisis, thankfully, isn't going to go anywhere unless, and there's a big unless, the federal government decides this is a good idea and subsidizes it.
Now, I saw the other day that the United States Air Force had bailed out of a coal to liquids plant that was slated for Montana.
That's right.
But what was not clear to me in the course of reading that article was whether they bailed out because coal to liquids is a bad idea or because they bailed out because it presented security conflicts with their other bases out there. Is the federal government still... taunt me. Taunt me. Yeah, you see, that taunting us to the good food out there. And the good beer.
The beer has a price.
Oh, well, it always does, even if they give it to you for free. But anyway, just to complete the thought, is the military on the verge of getting out of the coal to liquids advocacy business, or is this just a strategic choice in this Montana thing?
It's too soon to tell. There's no question I have that there are some people in the military who think this is a very good idea. In the specific case of the Maelstrom facility in Montana, their reasoning was a very site-specific concern. Nothing about the real issue, the real world issues we're raising, like coal prices, carbon prices, environmental concerns. But they were saying something about there are rockets that keep at the base. They weren't sure about security and et cetera. However, they also said they will be releasing environmental and economic concerns later. And it's possible that they are waiting for guidance from higher above to say, we're not building coal to liquids.
Well, because two states in the union that have governors that have been more advocacy oriented in favor of coal to liquids are probably Montana's Brian Schweitzer and our own Joe Manchin.
You can add Steve Beshear.
Oh, really?
Yes, he told the Kentucky legislature several months ago he wants $50 billion in investment in coal to liquid.
There have been meetings out at, for instance, a resort in West Virginia where our congressional delegation had a whole bunch of Air Force officers out there and got them to adopt this idea of wanting to fly Air Force aircraft on liquid coal. I'd like very much to find out that the Air Force has wised up. Are these policies something that you can have some, instead of bottom-up, you can have some top-down guidance from something like a presidential administration on?
I think absolutely. President Obama, we would love to hear from him that this is a bad idea. We've heard that we need a price on carbon from him, which has been a very welcome signal and one of the things that will finally put the final nail in the coffin for liquid coal. But the Department of Energy at the federal level has an appropriation from Congress, as it does currently, for $8 billion to give to advanced coal projects as loan guarantees, it's going to spend that money. So the only way it wouldn't is with a presidential directive. So in a certain sense, we very much need one. Otherwise, that money will be spent.
Yeah,
I should mention also
you can't just leave corporate welfare money laying around.
I should mention also that in the Senate version of the stimulus, that amount has been raised to $50
billion.
In the Senate version.
And that's probably in there to sweeten it up for the right wing who doesn't want the stimulus in the first place. I mean, is that your understanding?
That's my understanding, and I think it's also partially because, unfortunately, there are still people who are thinking of advanced coal as a green energy source.
Well, I don't know how long it's been since you've been over in West Virginia, but we have these, and the minute I mention this, somebody will post it in the chat room and you can see it. These obnoxious billboards.
Yeah.
Coal, clean,
power.
Carbon neutral.
Okay.
Carbon neutral. Carbon neutral coal. It boggles the mind. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to find out that the right wing is being appeased with some coal welfare. But you're doing magnificent work in Ohio there. How many people do you work with in this fight against, for instance, coal to liquids and this reinvigoration of our energy future?
We work with people at various levels, and one of the great things is because almost all of our activists are volunteers. There are very few people who are paid for this work. People engage to their own ability. So in terms of people who are spending like a part-time or full-time job equivalent on this, there are six or seven. In terms of people who are always willing to show up to a rally, take 2 or 3 hours out of their day, there are 20 or 25. When they're talking about people who are willing to sign a petition, there are hundreds, thousands, I would say.
How about doing advocacy work with the Ohio legislature?
I've gotten into a little bit of that. There was a bill, you'll love this one, in the lame duck session just last month in December, that would have stripped Ohio EPA of all oversight over mining permits and given it to Ohio DNR. So we were pretty heavily involved in lobbying the legislature to turn that down. They did. I mean, they passed the bill, but everything had been stripped out of it. It was a face-saving measure at the end by the coal industry to preserve, you know, some dignity. There you go. Wow. That's, clean carbon neutral coal. Well, if I could, I would just quote my friend and a great activist, John Blair. You know, you may know John.
Yes.
He always says, God invented carbon sequestration and called it coal.
Right. It's supposed to stay under there.
That's right.
Exactly.
The only clean coal is underground coal.
Well, Naki, and your last name again, please?
Canfer.
Canfer. Naki Canfer, I really appreciate you taking time to come by and chat with me. This has been a wonderful experience, and I think what I'm going to do now is I'm going to wrap it up and see if I can sneak off somewhere and at least see where the party was, because I've been out here talking during this whole thing. I wish you the absolute best in what you do. If you've ever got a message to get out, if you've ever got information that you want to get to a broad audience, some Ohioans, folks all across the country and all across the world, hang on to that. Call in anytime. You are a welcome voice on the horn, because it's voices like yours that the horn was designed to get out.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it so much.
It's a real pleasure.
Have a good night.
Take care.
Hope you get some food.
All right. And be careful going home.
I will. Thanks.
All right. Bye now. Naki Canfer from the Sierra Club, working in Ohio. Great conversation. Do you get a sense based on... Matt, look at you sitting over there. Come on. Get over here. Get over here. We're going to make Matt get behind the microphone. Rory's been behind the microphone. Eric's been behind the microphone. It's this or ride a goat, Matt. You choose. I mean,
yeah, where's the goat?
Matt Norpell from Coal River Mountain Watch, thanks for taking a minute. I promise we'll make this pay.
All right.
We haven't lost a guest yet. Tell us a little bit about what your work has been at Coal River.
I've been involved in a number of projects at Coal River. I'm sure you've talked a lot about the Coal River Wind Farm.
Sure.
Probably don't need to go into that. I've worked a bunch with coal slurry and coal slurry injections. I don't know.
Well, I was hoping that was mainly my reason in bringing you over here, because we've talked about liquid coal, we've talked about wind, we've talked about the overall devastation of mountaintop removal mining. And from time to time, the idea of slurry injection gets mentioned on the program. But, you know, it's an injection. You know, it's like you go get a flu shot. You get a little bit in your skin, and then you're all better. This is not that.
No, it's quite a bit larger. Order of,
I mean, what are they injecting, and what are they injecting it into?
So after you mine the coal, you have to clean it to get the the rocks that are just in the coal and around the coal out, and also to bring it into compliance with the Clean Air Act to get some of the sulfur out. And so you clean it with this mixture of chemicals and organic chemicals and also mineral chemicals and a whole lot of water, and you're left with the processed coal, and then you're left with this kind of thick slurry. And there's two ways of dealing with it. You can either put it in a dam, which they do occasionally, or you can inject it underground. And when they inject it underground, they basically they find an old coal mine that's been mined out and that they're not working in anymore, hopefully. They're not working in anymore, and they just pump it right down in there.
So they just take a tanker truck full of this stuff and drop a hose down an old mine shaft?
Yeah, pipeline right from the prep plant to the
I know for a fact that you spend a bunch of time with DEP permits and things like that. This is legal how?
It is. Yeah, good question. It's legal, and not only is it legal, but up until 1999, it wasn't legal or illegal. It just happened.
Nobody could imagine anyone would possibly want to do it.
Well, they knew about it. There was a study in 19. So all our knowledge of slurry injections comes from a study the federal EPA did between 1984 and 1986, where they basically sent around questionnaires to all the coal companies and asked, "Are you injecting? What are you injecting? How much of it?" And then that was it for 15 years until the underground injection control program got underway at the EPA. And they changed the rules up a little bit. They made rules, I should say. And they just went on with it.
So, now, see, I'm trying to think like a cult.
Right.
Okay. You get this letter in the 80s from the EPA saying, "Hey, are you injecting any coal slurry underground?" And maybe it goes to a coal company that isn't, and they go, "What? You can do that? Cool!" It almost seems like that could contribute to a larger problem. So that's the only science that's been done on it, or even statistical work that's been done on it. But what are we finding out? What are we finding out empirically is happening as a result of that? But first, where have they done it? How much have they done it? And what is the upshot from it?
They've done it. It's actually interesting. It's clustered in the southern part of the state, obviously, where the most coal is mined, in the Mingo, Logan, Boone, Raleigh area, and also way up north in around Morgantown in that area. I believe there's actually an injection underneath one of the wind farms.
Tucker County?
Yeah. It's an injection under there. That's where it's happening. They have a big problem up in the northern part of the state with it.
When you say a big problem, is it coming out?
Right, yeah. The Pittsburgh mine pool is up there, which is basically this over a trillion gallons of toxic water in underground mines. Mine shafts up there, abandoned underground mine shafts, and it threatens to come out, so they're constantly treating it and
putting it back
pretty much, yeah. Treat it, take out the clean water, use it to process coal, and then pump it right back.
Well, I mean, you're an environmental engineer.
Yes.
Is this scientifically viable?
No, it's actually not. It's pretty ridiculous.
Not even a little bit?
No, not quite. There's a major lawsuit in Mingo County, in the Raleigh area, because their water was contaminated with slurry injections.
I wanted to bring you around to the printer water project and things like that. How long does it take? Is there any way of benchmark knowledge? How long does it take for injected slurry to find its way into your world?
It's really dependent on the site. It's dependent on what seam of coal the slurry is injected into, what strata the people take their, where the wells are at, how deep the wells are, what the hydraulic conductivity is in the seam it was injected into. There's a lot of variables that it can take up, well, a year and, to the, 10 years.
The chemical content. So, in other words, you might not find out until your baby is a 10-year-old, or you
right.
might, or you might not find out until your 10-year-old's a 20-year-old.
Right.
That's kind of, isn't that sort of like having a poison hammer hanging over your head?
Yeah, and sometimes, like, so a lot of the wells, they'll look really bad, and you'll turn on the water, and it'll run red, or it'll run black, or it'll...